you, you, cause it goes on and on and on.
No more talking. Please, God, make it stop.
I wanna celebrate and live my life. Say it.
They're still talking. I can't believe they're still talking. Welcome to episode 130 of The Sound Off, where talking for 60 minutes straight is actually encouraged, which it should not be on TV. I'm the Solemn Monster. It is Sunday, October 17th, 2010. What a time for me to choose to watch my first full episode of Impact in months. We're going to get to that and a whole bunch of other stuff, including Matt Hardy finally being freed from his shackles, I guess you would say. Talk about some other stuff, too. First things first, I want to thank everybody who sent in feedback to last week's show, episode 129, which featured my exclusive interview with the zombie, Tim Arson. It's a fun interview. I enjoyed the hell out of doing it. Tim's a good guy. And it was a first for the podcast, so it was a big deal to me. And I do appreciate you sending in your feedback, good, bad, or indifferent. If you have not listened to that show, stop what you're doing now. Listen to that first and let me know what you think. Definitely a show to check out if you have not already done so. Good times were had by all. So, with that out of the way, let's backtrack a little bit to last weekend. I actually did see the TNA Bound for Glory pay-per-view. I did not pay for it. I saw it with a friend. Have a couple of thoughts on the pay-per-view. I guess we have to start there, given the big angle that took place at the end of the show before we talk about Impact here. I thought overall the pay-per-view was pretty average. Motor City Machine Guns Generation Me match was phenomenal. Just great stuff. Most of the stuff in the middle was pretty far from great. The women's match was terrible. I didn't really care much for the whole Eric Young, Orlando Jordan business. I know they're doing it for comedy. It's a mid-card feud, but it's not doing anything for me. The Kevin Nash thing in his match puzzles me a little bit, because what we've found out, unless this is all part of one big elaborate work, and with Russo and TNA, anything's possible, sounds as though Kevin Nash and possibly Sting are finishing up with the company. Nash is probably done, if he is to be believed, and Sting may be finishing up as well, even though I think his deal does not expire until the end of the year. If Nash is truly done with TNA, it makes even less sense for him to have pinned Samoa Joe at the pay-per-view with a powerbomb. I don't get that. I really don't understand that, but again, maybe Nash is just pulling our chain and he'll pop up on TV again in a couple of weeks. Even so, I think that was pretty fucking stupid. Joe has already been beaten down so much. He's lost so much of that aura that he once had. And for Nash to just pin him clean like that on the pay-per-view. Now, granted, the number of people watching the pay-per-view as compared to a normal episode of Impact, I mean, there is no comparison. I mean, a typical Impact, let's say, will have 1.9 million viewers. If TNA got 20,000 buys for that pay-per-view, they should be thanking their lucky stars. Now, the only thing that really mattered on the show, and also, you know, RVD and Abyss, their match, it was what it was. It was okay. You know, RVD took more abuse than I think he probably should have. I mean, him getting knocked off the ring at one point and falling through a barbed wire board on the outside, that looked like it sucked. That looked like it was not a fun thing for him to do. He got, I think the barbed wire cut him up a little bit on the nose. Why they're using real barbed wire, I'm not even sure. RVD wins, gets his revenge on Abyss. The main event, Kurt Angle, Jeff Hardy, and Mr. Anderson. Now, Angle was talking in the days before the pay-per-view about how excited he was about this match. He laid the whole thing out himself. He was going to go over it with Hardy and Anderson. It was going to be the match of the year. I don't know if it was the match of the year, but it was a pretty damn good triple threat match. I mean, it was really picking up towards the end there. And then, of course, Eric Bischoff comes out with a steel chair in hand. And you know at that point that no good could possibly come from this. Now, Bischoff comes to the ring, we hear the music, out comes Hulk Hogan on crutches. I said last week on the show that if they knew Hogan was going to be there and they didn't promote it, it was kind of stupid, but then again, let's be honest, Hogan's effect on pay-per-view buy rates, at least in TNA, it really isn't much. I don't know that there's any one person that could turn ratings or pay-per-view buys around in TNA. There is no one person that's going to just change everything. And so, whatever. If it's part of a big surprise, they saved Hogan for the pay-per-view, they swerved everybody, fine. Hogan comes to the ring. Him and Bischoff look like they're about to go at it. Jeff Hardy comes in, grabs a crutch. Of course, Hogan came out on crutches. Eric Bischoff has one. Hogan gives Hardy the other crutch, and of course, Hardy looks like he's going to hit Bischoff, turns around, and just absolutely wallops Kurt Angle over the back of the neck, no less, with that crutch. I couldn't believe that. Gimmicked or not, it looked to me like he hit him right over the back of the neck, which just is awful. He takes the crutch, the other crutch, and does the same thing to Mr. Kennedy, which I had no problem with. And then he proceeds to give him the twist of fate, pins Kennedy, and wins the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. Now, Jeff's new music, I have to say, goes kind of well with this new heel character. I kind of like the new music, at least the beginning of it. And like I said, it kind of goes with a more devilish character that I guess he's going to have now. So I thought that was actually kind of a neat tie-in there. I don't know if the new music was composed specifically because he knew he was turning heel. And based on what I understand, he's known this for about 6 or 7 weeks now. So Jeff Hardy is your new champion. They turn their biggest babyface heel. Now, we've seen other companies do this before. WCW did it in 96 with Hogan, which turned out to be one of the best things that WCW ever did, and it led to a big boom period for them and for the business. But the thing with Hogan back in 96 to keep in mind is that Hogan was already just beyond stale. I mean, he was already getting booed by people in the crowd, and people were more ready at that point for a Hulk Hogan heel turn than they would have been, you know, at Hogan's peak. I mean, this would be the equivalent of Hogan turning heel in 89. Only, obviously, that would have been far bigger. TNA didn't really have much going for it beforehand. You know, Jeff Hardy wasn't exactly turning thousands of people out for every house show, but it looked like he was making a difference in business in some aspects, and he was selling a shitload of merchandise. And, you know, in a way, it's kind of like Cena in WWE. You know, WWE's been very hesitant to turn him heel for a long time, mainly because of all the merchandise that he sells. And Jeff Hardy was one of the bright spots in TNA in that here was a guy that people genuinely looked at as a superstar. He was the biggest babyface in the company. It wasn't Anderson, it wasn't Angle, it was Jeff Hardy. So, it's a risk to turn him heel. I'm not going to trash TNA for doing it, though, at the end of the day, because it did feel like something fresh. And who knows? I mean, maybe Jeff Hardy is a heel worker. I don't believe Jeff Hardy has ever been heel in his entire career. I know he was never heel in WWE. So maybe Jeff Hardy turns out to be a much better heel than we all want to give him credit for. You know, based on what I saw Thursday night, he did a good job. He didn't do a great job or anything like that, but it's still very early. So I'm willing to give this a chance. But still, one must question the wisdom of them turning their biggest bona fide star heel. So, of course, we find out that Hogan and Eric Bischoff were part of They, which we've known all along. And then Jeff Jarrett comes out, Abyss comes out. Hogan and Abyss embrace. The one thing that really just, you know, you can justify the Hogan-Abyss thing, you know. They were swerving us when they turned on each other and all that. How do you justify Jeff Hardy and Abyss hugging and being bosom buddies after all the wars that they had? I mean, these two guys have been fighting each other tooth and nail for months. And then we hear Jeff Hardy go out on TV and say that he was the one who put Abyss up to attacking RVD with the nail-covered board. Well, then why did I watch Jeff Hardy and Abyss beat each other senseless on a baseball field in a Monsters Ball match in July? You know, why did I watch them on Impact and Reaction backstage beating the holy hell out of each other for weeks and weeks on end? I mean, I can cut TNA some slack, but shit, leave a little for me. So anyway, this is one of those classic Russo swerves. That doesn't make any sense, but whatever, it's wrestling. Let's suspend our disbelief for a second. Okay, fine. And that brings us to Thursday night. Now, first of all, before I get to that, Dixie Carter. Oh, Dixie Carter. She's been going Twitter crazy in character. And I just love this. One of the Twitter messages that Dixie Carter posted on her page after the pay-per-view was something to the effect of, Hogan and Eric already killed one company, but they're not going to kill mine. Now, again, I know she's doing this in character, but just think about the irony of this. You're acknowledging the fact that these two individuals put one of the biggest wrestling companies in existence out of business. which is not entirely accurate. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say it was Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff's fault that WCW died. It was also Hogan and Bischoff's fault that WCW did record ratings and record business at one point, but they certainly had a hand in the doom of that company. A lot of people did. But I just find it amazing that here's the president of TNA Wrestling, years and years and years after the demise of WCW, bringing the same two people that had a hand in the destruction of that company into her own company. But only now does it seem to bother her. Like, she didn't expect this. Like, she didn't see this coming. That brings us to Impact on Thursday night. So, anyway, I watched Reaction on Thursday night, which apparently had an early start time of 9 p.m. Eastern time. At least I could have sworn I was watching Reaction. All you need to know is that we had 6 minutes of wrestling. Actual wrestling on a two-hour show. Now, I know the main event with Anderson and RVD carried over into Reaction. That's a Bischoff thing. He likes doing that. I don't count the end of the main event. I'm talking about 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Fuck Reaction. 6 minutes of it on a two-hour show. Now, I understand this is a big angle, and this is a big change for TNA, and it's something fresh. Don't get me wrong. I'm all in favor of them trying something different, because obviously, whatever they were doing before wasn't working. So I acknowledge that this was a big deal, and in that respect, I'm fine with them dedicating, say, the first half an hour of their show to the angle. It's not like we haven't seen that on Monday Night Raw countless times where certain show opening promos go a full 30 minutes before we get to actual wrestling, okay? That's not unheard of. But they took this too far. If the wrestling is so inconsequential to this company, what is the point of this takeover? Why should we care? Why should they care? Who cares that they have taken over TNA? What are they taking over exactly? What are they fighting for? If the wrestling means nothing, what's the point? Like I said, go 30 minutes, 35 minutes without an actual wrestling match. To go, what I counted by my clock, to be about an hour and 13 minutes with not a single legitimate wrestling match. And I don't count that abortion of a women's match either. So don't throw that in my face. That was not a wrestling match. That is just inexcusable. On top of that, they condensed about what I would say is probably a good 2 months worth of angles into one show. I mean, we have Hogan's new faction, which I guess they're calling the Immortals. They come out. Then Fortune comes out. We have this another swerve, mind you, with Hogan hugging Ric Flair. So seemingly now the two factions have aligned themselves together, which just has Invasion written all over it. That was the first thought that popped in my head when I saw that. I mean, it just brought back horrible memories of July 9th, 2001. I'll never forget that date. Monday Night Raw. It was a tag team match. It was Chris Jericho and Kane against, I believe it was Lance Storm and Mike Awesome. And this was the night on Raw that Tommy Dreamer and Rob Van Dam did a run-in. They made their WWF debut. You know, they're helping Storm and Awesome against Jericho and Kane, beat them down. The bell is ringing. We need some WWF guys to come out. And who comes running out? You know, all the WWF guys that come out are former ECW guys. You know, you've got Taz, you've got the Dudleys, you've got Raven. They're standing there. They do a slow turnaround. Now they're all staring at Jericho and Kane. Jim Ross is going crazy on commentary, and you realize, holy shit, we've got an ECW invasion going on here. This is pretty fucking cool. And then, of course, an hour later at the end of the show, they completely fucked it up when they had the ECW guys align with the WCW guys to make one gigantic faction. And the ECW guys were being led all of a sudden by Stephanie McMahon. It was just one big clusterfuck. And this kind of reminded me of that a little bit. You know, this Immortals faction may well get over, but when all of a sudden you essentially merge, you know, the two groups. I'm not sure if it's an official merging of the two groups like the corporate ministry, but, you know, now you've got this humongous collection of guys. And there's just way too many people. So anyway, just some notes that I took here Post-show, because there was so much going on. I mean, I could see a casual viewer tuning into the show and just not knowing what the fuck is going on, just because there's so much shit happening at once. First things first, yeah, the beginning of the show, It's amazing that we've seen Eric Bischoff essentially commit fraud on national television. And the only thing I could think watching this little segment unfold was Dixie Carter's lawyer is a fucking idiot. You know, they're making a legitimate case as to why, you know, Bischoff essentially should go to jail. And Bischoff's response to all of this is, well, no, you're wrong. You know, you signed the contract. This, of course, is in referral to last week when Bischoff gave Dixie a contract to sign, which she did, but she clearly did so under false pretenses. She thought she was signing a release form for Abyss, when in actuality, I guess, it was Bischoff having Dixie sign the company away, sign control of her own company away. So anyway, that was pretty fucking stupid. You don't have to be a law student to know this is just complete ridiculousness and silliness. But again, it's wrestling, so let's look beyond that. I have the note here about Jeff Hardy and Abyss fighting each other. That I can't get over. I mean, it's one thing to have two guys who, if it's part of a swerve, maybe they're not getting along. Maybe they even just, they fight. You know, they get into these tussles, but then it's revealed in the end that they were actually in on it all along. That's one thing. But Jeff Hardy and Abyss have had matches. They've had Monster Balls matches. They've been throwing each other in thumbtacks and barbed wire, and it just doesn't make any sense. It does not make any sense. You have Kevin Nash and Sting, who were invited by Bischoff to come on down. Bischoff wants the two of them to join their faction, and Nash and Sting will have none of it. Sting is obviously too prideful a person to join. He loves TNA too much. Kevin Nash. Now, here's the deal on Nash. Nash had a contract with TNA that expired this past week. And in typical Nash style, each year that would go by when his deal would come up for expiration, he would do some sort of power play and threaten that he was going to quit and retire in order to get more money, which typically he has. Now, I'll give TNA credit if they did not re-sign Nash, if they did not give in to his demands. Good for them. Good for them. I don't think Kevin Nash has anything left to contribute to TNA. I really don't see what Nash can contribute to the TNA product that he hasn't already done. And you're going to give him more money? So if they didn't do that and they stuck to their guns, I give a lot of credit to Dixie Carter and TNA. But we'll find out, again, if it's part of a big swerve. But basically, Nash is done with TNA. I don't believe he got the deal he was looking for, and he's perfectly content to quit and walk away for now. But what's funny about it is Nash is notorious for caring only about the money, which is what he said in this promo. You know, Nash was going on in the past. He didn't give a shit about anybody else. It was only about the money. It was about himself. He was selfish. So in a way, he was kind of shooting. And he's preaching the virtues now, all of a sudden, of not being all about the money. It's not about the money anymore. When the irony of it is, this is probably the last impact he's going to be on before leaving over money issues. I just love it. So I had a nice hearty laugh at that. Now let's talk a little bit about the backstage segments. Now again, this entire first hour of Impact had no wrestling. There was zero wrestling in the first hour of Impact. So let me just remember that now. Now, TNA likes to do these. They have this shooting style, which is relatively new. It was a Bischoff thing where it's almost like documentary style, gritty, realistic shooting of backstage segments. I can appreciate the idea behind this because when I'm watching a WWE show, for example, and you've got two wrestlers who are clearly trying to have a private conversation backstage and the camera is up in their face, it just pisses me off so much. So I can appreciate the idea of, well, we're going to have a camera that's kind of eavesdropping on the wrestlers, unbeknownst to them, although you would think by this point the wrestlers would fucking know what's going on if they watch their own TV show. But anyway, I can appreciate that. The problem is this. They had a segment where when Nash and Sting left and they went backstage, they were confronted by the Pope, D'Angelo De Niro, who has been aligned with Nash and Sting the last couple of weeks. And the Pope is upset. He was not expecting Nash and Sting to walk out. They did not consult him about this. He's trying to find out, you know, come on, what's going on here? I thought we were together. I thought we were fighting for TNA. Now, I don't know if Sting said anything because I couldn't tell. Nash and Sting, their backs were turned to the camera. The camera was shooting from far away. We could see the Pope clearly. But Nash and Sting had their backs turned. So Nash was saying something at one point. I think, pretty sure he asked Pope to just come with them and Pope refused. All I know is that it was incredibly difficult for me to follow what was going on in the segment. And that's when it goes south, when they try to do these segments and they get a little too cute with the shooting style. It's one thing to shoot a segment and try to make it realistic like that. That's fine. I encourage that. I could not understand a fucking thing that was going on here because they were shooting those two guys from the back, and it was very difficult, unless you were really, really, really paying close attention, to tell what they were saying. Like I said, I don't know if Sting said a single word. He might have, but I couldn't tell. So that was pretty fucking stupid. And then we have a backstage segment again later on where Dixie Carter is beside herself. She is in Hogan and Bischoff's office. Now let me just say this. First of all, a couple of things about Dixie Carter in this segment. First of all, I thought it was hilarious that she called Eric Bischoff a smug shit, which they didn't bleep out, mind you. That was great. I'm going to give Dixie Carter credit for this segment. I'm not going to bash her. I actually liked what Dixie Carter did. Dixie Carter was almost unbearable to the point where I was hoping that Hogan would physically remove her from his office himself, which I'm sure Hogan is physically unable to do. But she did a very good job because she conveyed, in a realistic manner, this woman who was simply beside herself because her company was stolen out from underneath her, even though she should have seen this coming from a mile away. But it came off as realistic. You had some, you know, some of them were talking over each other, but at no point did I not understand what they were each trying to say. You know, in part because they were actually shooting this, you know, the proper way. But I thought Dixie did a hell of a job in this segment. You know, trashing Bischoff, and really she didn't have any interest in talking to Eric. She just wanted to talk to Hogan. You know, how could you have done this to me? And she had there was a framed photo on the desk of that press conference at Madison Square Garden when they first announced that Hogan was coming to TNA, and he was up on the podium with Dixie, and Hogan called her a piece of trash, and he told Gunner and Murphy, the two security goofballs, to remove Dixie from his office, which they did. As they're removing her, she's being taken out through the hallway, and she starts calling for who I thought was Sergeant Slaughter. Apparently it was Serge, her husband, not Sarge. Although that would have been pretty funny if she would have been calling for Sergeant Slaughter. So out comes Dixie's husband, who has to be the biggest jabroni in the world. Every time I've seen him on TV, which has really only been twice, the guy's been beaten down fairly easily. In this case, he got punched in the face, which I think was a legitimate punch because there were some photos, I think, on Dixie's Facebook page of her husband with a busted lip. So he got clocked in the face. One punch is all it took. He got knocked out. It looked like he was dead. He wasn't moving on the floor. And so that was the end of that segment. Again, the women's shit with Tara and Madison Rayne, it wasn't a match. I know there was a title change, but it wasn't a match. This was kind of the 2010 version of the Hogan-Nash finger poke of doom back in WCW, which, of course, did wonders for that company back in 99 after that happened. So Madison Rayne is your new Knockouts champion, which just, again, makes the belt look like shit. And we talk about WWE making their titles look like shit. TNA did that here with their women's belt. Not that it meant anything before. It's just kind of funny, though. You know, the Knockouts division in TNA once upon a time was the hot women's property in wrestling. You know, when they had Gail Kim and Awesome Kong and Tara and the Beautiful People and Hamada and Sarita and whoever else they had under contract at the time. It was mainly the feud between Kim and Kong that really brought in viewers. I mean, once upon a time, the Knockout segments on Impact were the highest rated segments on the entire show. I don't think that's the case anymore. But Rayne wins the belt. Mickie James came out. I guess they're going to go for a Mickie James, Madison Rayne feud. Whatever. Now, you might be asking, were there any legitimate wrestling matches on the show? When did they happen? Well, I'm glad you asked, because we didn't get our first legitimate wrestling match until about an hour and 15 minutes or so into the show. And all I could think of when I saw Samoa Joe coming out to the ring was, wait a minute, why is there a wrestling match interrupting all of this talking? So we have Joe come out, he has a match with Abyss, it went literally 2 minutes, Abyss grabbed the ring bell, busted open Joe, so of course the first TNA match on this entire show has to have blood in it, of course. RVD comes out, I don't know if that means the feud with him and Abyss is going to continue, I figured the pay-per-view was pretty much the blow-off to that feud, but whatever. So Joe, again, is meant to look like a pussy. Now, I should backtrack a little bit here, because before we got to that first match, there was even more talking. We had Kurt Angle come out. Kurt Angle apparently is supposed to be retired now. He's had this retirement stipulation for a while, where if he loses a match, until he wins the TNA title. If he loses a match, he's done. His career in TNA is over. Of course, nobody believed this. And it sounded, based on the back and forth between Kurt Angle and Jeff Jarrett, that Angle was suggesting because he didn't actually get pinned in the pay-per-view main event, it was Anderson that got pinned, that might be the way that they kind of get out of the stipulation. My whole thing is, why have the fucking stipulation in the first place if you're not going to live up to it? That's why these stipulations don't mean shit. You know, the idea that Team 3D is going to retire. Bullshit. They're not going to retire. They're going to break them up and they're going to have singles careers. Team 3D is not retiring. Nobody believes it. So why even bother promoting those stipulations anymore? So Kurt Angle and Jeff Jarrett, they go back and forth. They're doing this work shoot promo playing off the fact that Jarrett stole Kurt Angle's ex-wife away. Here's the thing I love about this. When that whole thing happened last year, whenever it was, where Jeff Jarrett and Karen Angle were found to be in a relationship and Dixie Carter was pissed at Jeff and she sent him home and he lost his primary control that he had in TNA, legitimately, not just in storyline. If I remember correctly, and I wasn't watching Impact every single week, so my memory may be a little bit fuzzy on this, but I do recall there being segments where the whole situation was acknowledged, but they never actually followed through with an angle. It looked like they were going to go in that direction. They were going to have a Kurt Angle, Jeff Jarrett feud based entirely around the whole Karen Angle thing. I know Jarrett and Angle did have a feud once upon a time, but I don't think they ever actually followed through on that feud, which means that you and I know the situation because, you know, we read about it. It was a big news story on the internet. If you go to any wrestling news sites, Angle himself has talked about it in radio interviews that he's done. I don't think Jeff Jarrett has talked about it too much, but if you're a regular Impact viewer, how the fuck are you supposed to know what the hell these two guys are talking about? Again, you have to put it in context. It has to make sense. I knew what they were talking about, but I could see where other people wouldn't, so that was pretty stupid. So it looks like they're going to play off this whole thing from last year. Talk about letting too much time go by. So, Angle comes after Jarrett. Jarrett beats him up. The security goofballs beat up Kurt Angle. And Jarrett throws Angle headfirst into a wall of some kind. And on commentary, they're going nuts because, oh, you know, Angle's got a bad neck. And then we see Taz, of all people, come out of the announce booth. And he's yelling. He comes to save Kurt Angle. He's yelling at Jeff Jarrett to back up. He's saying that Angle's got a fucked up neck. He's got a fucked up neck. Of course, they bleep that out. And here's the thing about Taz. Taz does an awesome job of playing a badass character. For a guy who, in real life, is as far from a badass as you could possibly find. Even, I mean, Taz himself has kind of said in interviews that Paul Heyman was a genius and that Paul Heyman in ECW was the one that gave Taz that whole human suplex machine, badass type character, you know, FTW, fuck the world and all that. When in reality, Taz was anything but a badass. So anyway, he plays that character very well, but he's fat, he's old, and he's not wrestling. He, you know, Taz himself has a fucked up neck, too. And physically, there isn't much he's willing to do, let alone a match. So, I guess it was cool to see Taz stick up for Kurt Angle, but it kind of made Jeff Jarrett look a little stupid. And unless it's going to lead to some sort of a tag team match or a match between Jarrett and Taz, I'm not sure what the point of all that was. I mean, when WWE does something every now and then that involves Jerry Lawler, it usually will lead to a match where Lawler will wrestle. I mean, ironically, if you remember the angle with Taz in WWF back in 2000 when Taz was kind of punking out JR at the announce booth and Jerry Lawler came to his rescue, it led to actually two pay-per-view matches between Jerry Lawler and Taz. It led to a SummerSlam match that Lawler won, and it led to a strap match at Unforgiven that Taz won. That was when Raven made his WWF debut. A little bit of useless trivia there. Anyway, so yeah, that came first, and then eventually we got the first match, which was between Samoa Joe and Abyss. We had another backstage segment during the show, which was great. We had Eric Bischoff talking to, I guess her name is Miss Tessmacher, who's been Bischoff's assistant for a while. She's a whore, and that's her character. She's a whore. Apparently she's slept with Kevin Nash and the Pope, and that was part of the TV storyline. Anyway, Bischoff fires her as his assistant. And the best thing about this was, Bischoff did the unthinkable to this poor woman. He basically relegated her to being a wrestler. But the thing is, in the course of cutting this promo, Bischoff cut it in a way that basically said, you know what, I'm going to make you nothing more than a professional wrestler. And at that point, she went off running and screaming and crying. And it's kind of funny that being a wrestler is frowned upon so much by this regime that it's like the lowest possible thing you can do is tell a woman, you're going to wrestle. I just thought that was fucking great. Oh, the horror of being a wrestler in TNA. I also love how they put the Pope in a 5-on-1 handicap match against Fortune. Pope was pretty competitive in this match. In fact, it looked like he might win in certain points. But the thing that I absolutely just was blown away by in this match, the heels, who, mind you, had a 5-on-1 advantage in this handicap match, had to cheat in order to win the match. Beer Money had to cheat in order to beat the Pope. Wow. Don't know what else to say about that. Anyway, the main event was RVD and Anderson in a match to determine the number one contender at Turning Point to Jeff Hardy's championship. There was no conclusive winner, which leads one to believe perhaps that we're going to be getting yet another three-way, which I hope not, but I'm not watching the next pay-per-view, so who cares? But again, the main event carried over into the first hour of Reaction. We had 6 minutes of wrestling in this two-hour show. You can point to all of the Raws, because I already had people emailing me about this, so let me just go off on these people here, to the fucking idiots that have emailed me. And I use that term not because these people have a differing opinion than mine, but because in these emails to me, it's one thing to say, well, Solomonster, you know, I saw your Facebook status where you said you were going to talk about Impact on your podcast, and I'm sure you're going to bash it, and you're just a hypocrite, and you're a WWE fanboy, and blah, 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 blah. Let me say one thing to these idiots. As I said earlier in this show, WWE is as guilty as anybody of having segments that start the show that go on and on and on and on and on. And I'm not even talking about the Cena Barrett one from Raw last week. I mean, they've had segments going back years that have literally gone 30, 35 minutes to start a show off. Never. I defy anybody listening to this podcast. You find me one episode of Monday Night Raw or SmackDown in its existence where an hour and 15 minutes went by without a single wrestling match. You cannot, because it's never happened before. So as guilty as WWE is of it, and I acknowledge that freely on this show, even they, and I'm not talking about Abyss's faction, even WWE has never quite gone this far. And I said earlier that this is a big angle for TNA. They're coming off a big pay-per-view. They want to do the big reveal on TV, let people know that, you know, it was Hogan and Bischoff had this plan all along. They want to introduce Jeff Hardy. Then they brought Fortune into the ring, and we have Ric Flair hugging Hogan. And now Bischoff is calling out Sting and Nash, who are sitting backstage watching a big screen TV. By the time Nash and Sting come out, that's another 10 minutes. Then they leave. And then that segues into another talking segment and another talking segment. And the thing is, the first half hour, 40 minutes of the show, I was okay with it because it was something different. It was unique, the Jeff Hardy thing. By an hour in, and I'm just a casual viewer here watching Impact. I don't watch Impact in full every week. I watch bits and pieces of it. Sometimes I'll watch the full show, but I mean, Thursday night, I'm sometimes out. I'm living life. I'm doing shit that I wouldn't be doing, let's say, on a Monday night. That's just the way it is, and I don't have DVR. But I'm watching this show, and we hit the hour mark, and I find myself, now I'm starting to get aggravated. So I start thinking, other people must be getting aggravated too. And clearly that was the case. I went online, I'm looking on Twitter, I'm looking on Facebook. People are just ripping the show apart. I wasn't ripping the show apart an hour in. I just thought to myself, man, now, you know, it finally hit me. Where's the fucking wrestling on this show? You know, and then we get to an hour and 10 minutes, and I'm like, all right, you know what? Now I'm getting angry. This is beyond ridiculous. And it's another 5 minutes before we finally have Samoa Joe come out. So we know that the person writing this show is a fucking moron. I mean, this is his specialty. Swerves and talking and just overwriting everything. I just remember when Russo talked about that January 4th show, when Impact went live at the beginning of the year, it took him something like 3 months to write that show. It took him 3 months to write one wrestling show. I could write an episode of Raw or Impact in a day. So can you. Now, it might not be a great episode, or maybe it would be a great episode, but the fact is, Here's a guy that has freely admitted in the past that it's taken him 3 fucking months to write one television show. I don't care how big that show was. It should never, ever take you that long to write one television show. If you had writers in Hollywood who wrote sitcoms, okay, one episode of a 22-minute sitcom, and it took them 3 months to write that episode, they would be fired. Which is what Russo should have been a long time ago. We've established this, but he hasn't. And he clearly hates wrestling, so my question is, why even have a ring? I remember years ago, I don't know how true this was, I just remember reading that Vince McMahon was giving serious consideration to having one episode of Raw as kind of like a test run without a wrestling ring. And thankfully that never happened, but it was being talked about in WWE. What I don't understand is, Russo's writing in TNA, why not just get rid of the ring? Why don't you guys do it? Have an episode of Impact without a ring. Just call it Reaction. 3-hour Reaction. And it's a shame, too, because from what I've seen of Reaction, it's actually a really good show. But when I was done with Impact on Thursday, I was done. There was no way I was watching Reaction at 11 o'clock. There was simply no way. So it's a shame because Reaction this week may have been just as good, but they completely turned me off. I just could not stomach another hour of TNA at that point. I turned my TV off. Now, the ratings came in for Impact on Thursday. And it's kind of interesting here. You know, one segment I actually completely forgot to mention during Impact, which was probably the biggest thing they were promoting, was this Jersey Shore bullshit. You know, they have this Robbie E or Robbie G, whatever the fuck his name is, and Cookie, of course, is a spoof on Snooki of the Jersey Shore. They just introduced this act the week before. So this is only their second week on TV. And they were promoting the fact that JWoww, who was a character on the actual MTV Jersey Shore show, was coming to Impact to confront Cookie. Mind you, this is only the second week Cookie is on TV. So they pay this woman $15,000 to come in and do this segment with the belief that they would like to have her back again and pay her the same $15,000, I would guess. They may want to rethink that after the ratings came in this week. First of all, Impact did its biggest audience since the beginning of the year. They did not do a record rating, but they did do their biggest audience. I think it was a 1.4, I believe, was the final overall rating. But I'm looking at the quarter hour ratings here, and it's kind of interesting. Impact lost viewers throughout the entire show. So in other words, from whatever that opening quarter hour was, which was a 1.53, not once during the entire rest of the 2-hour show, and this doesn't count Reaction, did they actually increase their ratings. So in other words, they dropped from a 1.53 to a 1.52 to a 1.41 to a 1.42 to a 1.43 to a 1.35 to a 1.37 to a 1.23. The main event got a 1.2 rating, which is interesting because that came right after the Jersey Shore bullshit. I don't know what that means, but, you know, Impact, it's kind of interesting. Impact has had this pattern before where the main event always does the worst quarter hour of the show. If that happened with Raw, Vince McMahon would just flip out. But Impact, it's become commonplace where people just, they'll tune in at the beginning, especially if there's something interesting like this whole angle, but they'll tune out in droves as the show goes on. So I don't know how Reaction did. I don't really give a shit, quite frankly. But it's just interesting. You know, Bischoff went on his Facebook the other day, and people, I guess, were sending in messages bashing him, and he said, oh, yeah, we'll see who has the last laugh. I bet, you know, Impact does a record rating this week. Well, they didn't do a record rating, but they did a pretty good one. So the question is, what are they going to do next week? That's the bigger question. And judging by the number of viewers they lost as the show went on, I'd say it doesn't look too good. My guess is they'll end up right back to where they were before. So, you know, hooray, you got a great rating 1 week. Whoop-de-fucking-do. Let's see what you do the week after. I was not a fan of the show, as you can tell. There were aspects to like. Really, the only thing I could say is that it's unique seeing Jeff Hardy play a heel character. It's too early to tell how he'll do, but it's interesting. Beyond that, there was nothing on this show that got me to think, man, I got to tune in next week. If anything, it did the exact opposite. I could see people tuning in for the first time who are kind of into some of the stuff, but again, an hour and 15 minutes without a wrestling match, I can't get over that. At their worst, WWE never did anything like that. Way to go, TNA. Speaking of fucking idiots, Matt Hardy got his release this week from WWE, and it seems like it was something that Hardy did that was finally the straw that broke the camel's back. He posted a video on his YouTube channel a couple of days ago that it was an old video from a couple of years ago. It featured him, I think it was Jimmy Wang Yang, R-Truth, and Rey Mysterio eating lunch at a Japanese restaurant. And in the video, at one point, it kind of shifts over to Rey Mysterio, who's sitting there unmasked. Now, I've seen Rey Mysterio. We've all seen Rey Mysterio unmasked if you saw him in WCW, but I've actually seen Rey in person without the mask, shopping in a store or whatever, and it's not a mystery what he looks like. But WWE does not like it when Rey is shown unmasked. And let's be honest, why else would Matt Hardy put up this old video unless he wanted to piss off WWE because Rey Mysterio happens to be unmasked in this video? Now, I think it's a dick move on Hardy's part just because Rey is still working for WWE. Now, this is not Rey's fault. I mean, it's any person with half a brain would not blame Rey Mysterio for this, but we're talking about WWE here, where you can get heat because you sneeze in front of Vince McMahon. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that WWE would see this. They would know that Rey is friends with Matt Hardy. Here he is being shown unmasked in a video, and WWE thinking, well, why would you allow yourself to be filmed unmasked? And now Rey Mysterio has heat because of it. So anyway, that's a dick move on Hardy's part, but it worked. Because a day or two later, WWE announced on their website that he was being given his official release. He was gone from World Wrestling Entertainment, and that ends the Matt Hardy era. So he got what he wanted. Congratulations. Now, I have no idea if part of this release, if there was any sort of negotiation where they agreed to let him go and waive the 90-day clause. My guess is no. Why would they do that? If I'm Vince McMahon, if I'm Vince McMahon, I never even would have let the guy go. He had about a year and a half left under contract. I would have said, fuck it, let him rot. But even so, if they let him go, you let the 90-day clause stand, because if you waive it for Matt Hardy, that sets a horrible example for other people who leave your company under good circumstances. I mean, Matt Hardy was anything but the model employee the last couple of months, last couple of weeks, and so you're going to reward him by waiving the 90-day contract clause? So my guess is he's going to TNA, that goes without saying, but it's going to be at least 90 days before we see him there. And if he pops up on TV in 2 weeks, then I guess we'll know that WWE waived it. But I just don't see a reason why they would do that. You're rewarding bad behavior by doing that, because that's exactly what he wants. So it'll be 90 days of him sitting around doing YouTube bullshit and restarting Omega or whatever other stupid things he said he was going to do. You know, what do you do with the guy? Let's say he goes to TNA. In a way, it would kind of make sense that his brother turned on the fans. He's a heel now, so Matt can come in as a big baby face and can feud with his brother. It would make sense, but we've seen Matt versus Jeff, and it's always failed. It failed when they did it in 2001, and it failed when they did it last year. People don't want to see Matt Hardy against Jeff Hardy. So you can put the two of them together, but then you're making both Hardy boys heels. You know, and Matt as a heel is... Hey, it's easy enough for me to look at Matt as a heel because he's been a heel the last couple of weeks in real life. But I'm not sure what you do with him when you come in. Do you just put him into the faction and he just becomes another body in Hulk Hogan's Immortals? Or do you keep him on the babyface side, promote him as your new big babyface with RVD and with Anderson, and basically build to a Matt versus Jeff match that I'm not so sure is going to draw very well because nobody wants to see the two of them fight each other? So it's kind of a catch-22. I'm sure TNA cannot wait to bring him in, and he'll be an asset to the company. He's a talented guy. nobody ever said Matt Hardy didn't have any talent. It's just he's gone a little cuckoo the last couple of weeks, and hopefully he'll get back on his meds. I thought Raw from last Monday night was actually a fun show, the complete opposite of Impact. That's right. I'm giving my props to Raw and not Impact this week. Big shock, I know, but I defy anybody to tell me that Impact was a better show than Raw. Raw wasn't a great show, but when Raw was over, I wasn't angry. That's my best barometer to judge how good a wrestling show was. If my level of anger is below that of the other show, then I will give that show the win for the week. So Raw gets the win for this week. Sheamus and Daniel Bryan had a really fun match. When I realized that Daniel Bryan was wrestling in his hometown, I knew he was losing. It's pretty much a dead giveaway in WWE. One of the few times I could ever remember a babyface winning in their hometown was when Trish Stratus won the women's title and retired in Canada at the Unforgiven pay-per-view back in what I believe was 06. It's happened a couple of times since then, I'm sure, but more often than not, when you're in your hometown, it means you're doing the job. And having known that going in, I thought they gave Daniel Bryan a hell of a lot to work with. I mean, whereas last week, he didn't have any offense at all. He got kneed into oblivion. Literally, he got kneed into unconsciousness. He was made to look like a complete idiot. But he went toe-to-toe with Sheamus this week. At one point, Sheamus was down on his knees, and Daniel Bryan was giving him these rapid-fire succession of kicks to the chest and a kick to the head. The place was going nuts. They were going crazy for Daniel Bryan. So even in defeat, he was made to look really, really good. And it kind of makes up for making him look like an idiot the week before, but not exactly. The other thing I loved about the show was the end. The stuff with Wade Barrett and John Cena was phenomenal. It was just phenomenal. Wade Barrett is really, really good, in case you didn't notice, on the microphone. He's improving in the ring, but on the mic, he's already there, in my opinion. He's among the great talkers in the company right now. And the stuff, of course, Cena can't touch him unless he wants to get fired. Cena made it clear at the beginning of the show that if he's fired, he can't just go to SmackDown. If he's fired, he's gone. He didn't explain why that is, so I have no idea, but apparently he was told that if he's fired, he can't just go to SmackDown. So, sucks for him. So, there's not much Cena can do. He had to take a lot of verbal abuse at the end of Raw. There was he looked like he was just ready to explode. He was making all these weird monkey faces, and he looked a little goofy at one point making those faces, but the crowd was eating this shit up. I mean, the place was going bonkers. And even I found myself just dying for Cena to just smack him in the face, and he didn't. You know, I was worried they were going to just ruin the angle right there, but they didn't. They didn't blow their load, if you will. Cena walked off looking like a defeated man, and Barrett tells him to turn around, and he says, "You can't see me," and I just love that. That was great. So they're building this up in a fantastic way. I'm a little worried that they'll fuck it up because they've fucked up a lot of other stuff before, but they can milk this for a few months, I think, before they do the big blow-off match. You know, Cena versus Barrett at WrestleMania, I'm not sure if that's the WrestleMania match you want Cena to be in. I still think Cena-Undertaker, if you can't get Sting in, let's say, to do an Undertaker match, you know, Cena-Undertaker is the biggest Undertaker match you can do. And, you know, maybe you can hold off if Taker's still around for 28 and do the 20-0 thing with Cena in 2012, but that's still a long ways away. Cena, Barrett, I just don't see them being able to sustain that until WrestleMania. You know, maybe Royal Rumble or TLC at least in December, but we'll see. But what they did at the end of Raw Monday Night, good stuff. Loved it. Now, putting Santino and some of the people that they did in this bragging rights match, not so good. I mean, Santino is great. He's a great comedy act. But putting him in one of your main pay-per-view main events, yeah, that's not going to sell too many bragging rights pay-per-views, I don't think, this year. Bragging rights is going to do just phenomenally poor. We already know that. They didn't need to have two pay-per-views in the month of October. And Hell in a Cell is probably going to do bad enough. But bragging rights, because they haven't made this match feel important. I mean, look what they're doing on SmackDown. You've got Big Show as the team captain. Hornswoggle is your comedy mascot. You know, even if some of the stuff is funny, this is a pay-per-view main event. This is your big Raw vs. SmackDown match that you're promoting that you want me to pay $45 for. Fuck that. I'm not paying 45 cents. So, yeah, that I didn't like. This match is just does not feel important at all. There's nothing on the line. I guess maybe they'll dust off the trophy maybe and bring that back out. But having this match for nothing but bragging rights, that doesn't cut it. You've got to put something on the line. I mean, they moved Edge over to SmackDown. They moved CM Punk officially over to Raw. I thought the Punk Evan Bourne stuff was also great on Monday night. Evan Bourne went in for shoulder surgery, so they knew he was going to be out. So they brought Punk over from SmackDown, and they made him look strong. They made Punk into a monster, destroying Evan Bourne. Good stuff. But bragging rights, not so good. Our friend Corey emailed me his NXT report for this week, the show that nobody watches, except Corey, on WWE.com. Corey thinks that the show has actually gotten better since it left TV. I don't know about that, but I'll take your word for it. Let's see here. The key stuff here, it was a match between Naomi, who's probably the most athletic of the bunch, and Alicia Fox. Alicia won the match after Naomi missed a crossbody. We had a competition where the NXT Divas were going to show off their personalities. Naomi had 1 minute to talk about Michael Cole. She said that Cole is negative and is no Jim Ross. So Cole goes on to say that he's not fat with a cowboy hat, and that Naomi is very original with her JR joke. She also made fun of Michael Cole's hair. Well, at least he doesn't frost it like he used to do. Let's see here. Some other assorted bullshit happened. We had a match in the main event between AJ and Oksana. Oksana, of course, the storyline here is that she's gravely worried that she's going to be deported. And she ends up losing this match. AJ won with a roll-up. Goldust, who is Oksana's pro, comes to her after the match, gets in the ring, and says that he knows she's worried about her situation. He explains her options and proposes to her, proposes marriage in order to save her from being deported. Oksana accepts, and so it looks like we're going to have another wedding. But you know what? Good for Goldust. First of all, Oksana, as annoying as she may be, is a very attractive woman. And we know how these things tend to work sometimes in wrestling when you put a guy together with a girl. So good luck to Goldust. Hopefully he can make that work out for him, both in storyline and in real life. But Goldust has two storylines now. I almost didn't realize. He's got the storyline with Oksana on NXT where he's going to marry her. And he's also involved in a program on Raw with Ted DiBiase where he's stolen DiBiase's $1 million belt. In fact, on his Twitter, Goldust was posting pictures with his phone this past week. He was at home. He had a picture of his dog sleeping on the floor with the $1 million belt draped over its belly. His daughter Dakota, who's all grown up from when she used to be on WWE TV, posing with the $1 million belt. So good for Goldust, man. I mean, he's got his book coming out in December, which is, don't get me wrong, I mean, that's entirely the reason that why he's being pushed on TV all of a sudden. But, you know, good for Dustin. I mean, he's really gotten himself in the best shape of his career. He moves around like he's 10 years younger. He's got a great mind for the business. He's a good veteran to have on the roster, and he deserves an opportunity to be on TV. So good for him. So thanks to Corey, as always, for sending in his NXT report. Keep on doing that so we can keep up with what's going on in the wonderful world of NXT. Now, for all the venom I heaped on TNA for their shit show this week with 6 minutes of wrestling, got to talk about SmackDown here. I have not yet watched all of SmackDown, but I've seen what I needed to see. When I read the spoilers earlier in the week and heard about Caval wanting to be on Team SmackDown at Bragging Rights and the Big Show kind of blowing him off and then saying, "All right, kid, if you can last 5 minutes in the ring with me, I'll give you a spot on my team." And Caval ends up lasting 5 minutes with the Big Show, even though it looked like at the very end he was going to lose, but then time ran out, so Caval won and earned himself a spot on Team SmackDown. And then I read that Tyler Rex, and it took me a minute to realize who Tyler Rex was. Tyler Rex used to be, I think, on the old ECW on Sci-Fi. He made a couple of appearances. I think he's redone his look. When I saw Tyler Rex on TV, the first thought I had was, holy shit, Rob Zombie is in WWE. With the beard and the dreadlocks, he looks exactly like Rob Zombie, only physically in much better shape. But when I read the spoilers that Tyler Rex came out after this competition, challenged Caval. Caval accepted, even though Teddy Long wasn't going to make the match, but Caval accepted, and then got beat by Tyler Rex, and Tyler Rex took his place on Team SmackDown at the pay-per-view. I thought, okay, these spoilers are obviously bullshit. This can't possibly be what happened. So I watched SmackDown on Friday night, and sure as shit, Caval wins, lasts 5 minutes with the Big Show, who did a fine job on commentary, by the way. And then Tyler Rex comes out, and look, Tyler Rex, with his new look, if in fact it is a new look, to me it's a new look, because I haven't seen him on TV in ages. He's got a very unique look, and I can, you know, he's got a very unique look, and I can see where people would not be afraid of him, but would be interested in watching him because he does have a unique look. Maybe he gets pushed as a mid-card act on SmackDown. I would have no problem with that. The problem I have is, who the fuck is Tyler Rex? And why is he on Team SmackDown at the pay-per-view? I mean, I guess if you've got Santino Marella on Team Raw, then Tyler Rex can't be much worse. They've got a very unique way of pushing Caval. They've got a very unique way of pushing guys that they actually want to get over. I mean, Daniel Bryan was a great example of that.
forget the shit that happened with Daniel Bryan and choking out Justin Roberts. I mean, when they had Daniel Bryan come out last week and get just obliterated by Sheamus, I think I even said it on the show that here's a guy they actually like. They're not punishing him. He didn't do anything wrong. They really think that by doing that, they're getting him over. Now, they rehabbed him a little bit by giving him some offense against Sheamus before he ultimately lost again on Monday night, but Caval's a guy that actually is getting over with the crowd. The crowd likes him a lot. And him being on Team SmackDown at a pay-per-view that's not going to do any buys anyway wouldn't have made a big difference. But for him, it would have been a big deal because it's his first WWE pay-per-view. By the way, doesn't he get a title shot? I haven't heard them mention that at all. I bet they forget about it, too. I think by winning NXT, he earned himself a title shot. I don't think he's cashed in on that yet. In any event, this was fucking stupid. I'm not saying Tyler Rex shouldn't be given a chance, but the way that they did this was so incredibly short-sighted that I don't even know what to say. I don't even know what to say. Maybe Caval comes out next week and gets his spot back by beating Tyler Rex. Maybe that happens. But if it doesn't happen, then I don't understand what the point of this was at all. I mean, Tyler fucking Rex, are you kidding me? Anyway, just a quick note on the Hall of Fame here before we get into your feedback. Notice this from the Wrestling Observer newsletter this past week. Some of the names in discussion regarding the Hall of Fame next year. Ron Simmons, who of course was WCW champion at one point, beating Vader, I believe that was back in 92, and had a nice little career for himself in WWE as well. Lex Luger and Bill Goldberg. Again, the belief here is that they want to do something of a WCW class or an NWA class, being that they're in Atlanta for WrestleMania next year. So Simmons, Luger, and Goldberg would all be fine potential candidates for that. They want to do, apparently, a Four Horsemen induction as a group, as opposed to just doing Arn Anderson, who's probably going in no matter what. If they do that, that would presumably include J.J. Dillon, who had some heat with Vince McMahon. I guess they must have patched things up in recent years. And whoever else they want to consider. Obviously, you could forget Benoit. You could Dean Malenko. I don't see them putting Dean Malenko in the Hall of Fame. Or Sid or Paul Roma. Or you know, Barry Windham, I guess, could. Barry Windham was part of the Four Horsemen in the late 80s. In fact, when you ask Ric Flair what his favorite incarnation of the Four Horsemen was, it's the incarnation that included Barry Windham. It was not the original Four Horsemen. So I suppose you can do that, but the thing is, they're only going to do that if Ric Flair is no longer under contract to TNA. And I just don't see Ric Flair leaving TNA. He seems very happy there. He's in a prominent role. They let him wrestle. WWE would never let him wrestle. So I just don't see him leaving TNA, which means you could pretty much forget about a Four Horsemen induction next year. That would be my guess. I would be shocked if they end up doing a Four Horsemen induction. And doing one without Ric Flair, you can't do that. You know what I mean? You can't do that. They want Sting, which is no surprise, but again, Sting has to officially be gone from TNA in order for them to even consider putting him in the Hall of Fame. So, yeah, they're going to move forward with this idea. I think Simmons, Luger, and Goldberg, if they could successfully negotiate something with Goldberg, they're probably locks for the Hall of Fame. Beyond that, it is very much up in the air right now. Another quick note here. We have a listener here. I hope he's listening. Romeo Hughes, if you're listening, you have a hacked email account. So you need to start emailing me from a different address because I can't open your emails anymore. I'm putting them in my spam folder automatically and not reading them. So unless you get that problem fixed, you're going to have to start emailing me from another email address. So just wanted to put that out there for Romeo. All right, before we get to feedback, actually, I almost forgot. I watched the Chris Jericho documentary this week. I finally got to watch the documentary on the Jericho DVD set, which is phenomenal. And yeah, I may as well do a quick review of it here. For those of you who have not yet watched it, or if you're on the fence about buying it, what are you waiting for? Go pick it up. I have not watched any of the matches yet on Disc 2 or Disc 3, but I did watch the documentary and some of the extras on Disc 1. The documentary itself ran a little under 2 hours. So it's actually a really extensive documentary. They left out very little of the stuff that I would have expected them to. I obviously did not expect them to cover any of the matches that Chris was involved in with Chris Benoit. So if anybody's thinking, wow, I hope Benoit's on the DVD, yeah, think again.
he's not on this one, and he won't be on any other ones going forward either. That's a shame, because I think some of Jericho's best matches were with Benoit. In fact, I think it was Vince McMahon who might have made a comment to Jericho backstage after his match with Benoit at the 2001 Royal Rumble, that it was the greatest ladder match he had ever seen. That was a phenomenal ladder match that those two guys had. And, of course, Jericho and Benoit were partners when they won the tag belts from Austin and Triple H in that awesome match on Raw back in 01 when Triple H tore his quad. None of that stuff is covered on the DVD, which should be a surprise to nobody. But almost everything else is. It's Jericho sitting, you know, they conducted an interview with him, obviously, within the last couple of months. And it talks about him growing up as a kid. He was involved in a lot of different sports. He played hockey, soccer, baseball, swimming. He's an avid swimmer. It talks about him going to the Hart Brothers training camp, which was ironic because there were no Hart Brothers there. As Jericho says on the DVD, Keith Hart showed up on day one to kind of just, I guess, do an intro and take your money. And, you know, they had a lot of very competent people doing the training, but it was not any of the actual Hart Brothers. And he tells the story of him and Lance Storm meeting at that camp and literally being the only two people there athletic enough to have a shot and serious enough to have a shot at becoming wrestlers, which both of them did. And Jericho went to Mexico, became a big star in Mexico. He went to... it's interesting because Jericho covers his time in each of the different places of the world that he honed his craft. And he learned something different in each of these areas. So, for example, in Mexico, he learned to cut promos. In Germany, he learned a different type of psychology because they would literally wrestle in the same building 6 weeks straight every night in front of the same people. And as he says on the DVD, you can't do the same moves. You can't have the exact same match every night if you're wrestling in front of the same crowd. So in Germany, he learned to kind of change it up a little bit and to adapt and to do something different each night to please the crowd. In Japan, which was one of his goals from the very beginning, because he knew most of the great wrestlers that he grew up idolizing passed through or came from Japan. I think he wrestled a lot with Ultimo Dragon in Mexico, and Dragon, I think, was... I think he said he was instrumental in bringing Jericho over to Japan, and in Japan, Jericho learned how to actually wrestle technically. In Japan, it was very different back then, more so than it is now, but it was very different from the U.S., for example, or even Mexico, in that you can have a personality and you can be a great promo guy, but in Japan, wrestling is what mattered. And if you couldn't wrestle, you were never going to make it. So he learned something different in each place before he ultimately ended up in the U.S. Him and Lance Storm made their debut in the Jim Cornette's Smoky Mountain Wrestling promotion around 94. They were the Thrill Seekers. And there were some awesome Thrill Seekers vignettes on this DVD as some of the extras. You've got to see. There's one video in particular. It's a workout video set to some really cheesy music. I'm guessing maybe they dubbed it over, but it's cheesy enough where maybe it's the original music they used back then. But it's basically this long video set to cheesy music of Jericho and Lance Storm in a gym somewhere just training and doing workouts. And they leave the gym. They're walking in a hotel down they're on the floor. They're about to key into their hotel room, and all of a sudden they look up, and there are these two women standing there, and the women pull them into another hotel. It's the cheesiest, hokiest thing you'll ever see, but you have to see it at least once. You can probably even find it on YouTube, but just buy the DVD and watch it on there. It's just great stuff. You know, he covers all the major aspects of his WWE career and his WCW career. I mean, they cover him in ECW. Eric Bischoff saw him wrestling at the World Wrestling Peace Festival, offered him a contract on the spot. He went to WCW. He was a very instrumental part of their cruiserweight division. And, you know, Jericho even says in the DVD, look, the NWO was a hot angle. It was one of the hottest angles in the history of the business. But he firmly believes as big as the NWO, as far as what helped bring people into their product, was the cruiserweights, which I actually support that 100%. That was something that WWF at the time was not doing. And actually, when WWF finally got around to bringing in their own light heavyweight division in 97, it was a direct answer to WCW's cruiserweight division, and it still wasn't nearly as good. So Jericho talks about coming to WCW, doing that, being given the creative freedom to start to be himself. I mean, he was the white bread babyface, you know, Lionheart Chris Jericho for a long time, and he just got so sick of it. He came to Nitro one night. Terry Taylor pulled him aside and said, look, you're going heel tonight. And he was happy as a pig in shit. And at that point, we got to see Jericho come out of his shell. He was cutting these amazingly creative promos. They talk about the Man of 1,004 Holds promo, which is actually on there in full as an extra. At the time, he was feuding with Dean Malenko, whose moniker was, I'm the Man of 1,000 Holds. So Jericho one-upped him and said, yeah, well, first of all, you only know about 200, but I'm the Man of 1,004 Holds. I know four more holds than you. And Jericho came to Nitro. He had a match. And after his match on this particular night, he, in the corner, had a stack of computer paper and unfolded the list. It was as long as it could possibly be. And he proceeded to run down his list of 1,004 holds. He probably mentioned armbar about 600 times. They went to a commercial break. They came back. He was still doing the list. It was just fantastic stuff. They cover him doing the conspiracy victim angle in WCW, where he felt he was a conspiracy victim and he was going to get to the bottom of it. He went to Washington. They did this vignette where he went to the Library of Congress to look up, you know, rule, like WCW rule book rules and rules on championship belts and whether or not a person can be stripped of a title and all, just all this great stuff. And that vignette is on there in full as an extra too. And then they cover the stuff as far as him and Goldberg. He was mocking Goldberg, and they were building for 2 months to what you would think was a pay-per-view match, a pay-per-view blow-off between Jericho and Goldberg. And it's, you know, not that Jericho expected Goldberg to lose to him, but Jericho thought this thing was being built up so beautifully, and Goldberg, first of all, didn't like the fact that Jericho was making fun of him. He took himself way too seriously at the time. And then WCW wanted to do something where they'd have a minute-long blow-off, I think, on TV. And Jericho stood his ground and said, look, I don't think this is the right thing for business. He really, really felt that this was his first opportunity to show people in WCW that he could make money for them. He thought this was a pay-per-view worthy match, and they never did it. And at that point, Jericho realized, I got to get the hell out of here. And moved on to the WWF. They talked about his debut, which, you know, to this day is one of the top all-time wrestling debuts. I don't know that I would put it at number one because I'm still very partial to Kane's debut in 97, which is one of my all-time favorite wrestling debuts, was when Kane debuted at the Hell in a Cell at Bad Blood. But this was way up there. And jaw-jacking with The Rock on his first night in. And then Jericho says it went south very quickly because they had a pay-per-view in October that he was not booked on. And he was very angry about that. And he felt 2 months in, he's not being given the opportunities that he thought he was going to have. And then Vince McMahon comes to him and asks him if he would mind working with a woman. You know, and Jericho on the inside thought, this is a terrible idea. But, you know, to Vince McMahon, he said, sure, absolutely, no problem. And Jericho figured it was his all-time goal, not to be world champion, but to be the Intercontinental champion. Because growing up, he knew that people, great workers like Ricky Steamboat, had held that belt. And he always aspired to hold the Intercontinental belt. And he figured, well, China at the time had the Intercontinental title. She had beaten Jeff Jarrett for it. And Jericho justified this by figuring, at the end of this angle, the payoff here has to be that I win the belt. And sure enough, that's what happened. He became the Intercontinental champion. They have footage. They actually, I think, on disc 2 have the entire match. One of the great Raw matches of all time. From State College, Pennsylvania in April of 2000. That was the night that Jericho beat Triple H to become WWF champion before they took the belt away from him in the very next segment. And the place just went apeshit when he won the belt. I mean, this was the night that Jericho got his confidence back and realized that he could do big things and that he could be a world heavyweight champion. And they just cover, you know, a lot of different things from that point on. They cover his feud, his ongoing feud, and then later his alliance with Stephanie McMahon, beating Rock and Austin at Vengeance in 01 in one night to become the Undisputed Champion, main eventing WrestleMania against Triple H. And Jericho himself on the DVD says that his match was not the main event. He could not understand why they were putting his match on last with Triple H. He knew as well as everybody else that Rock versus Hogan was the main event. And he did not want to have to follow that match. And unfortunately, that's what they had to try to do, and they failed. That match, there were people walking out of Sky Dome that night during the main event. And it's not Jericho's fault, but it's just funny on the DVD to hear him admit what we've already known, that the real main event that night at WrestleMania 18 was Rock versus Hogan. So he talks about being disappointed about that, and you know, his tag team with Christian, his feud later on with Christian, his WrestleMania 19 match, which is his all-time favorite match with Shawn Michaels, his later feud with Shawn Michaels back in 2008, and the great stuff they did then. The one thing I was disappointed, they didn't really dwell on the SummerSlam angle when Jericho, quote-unquote, inadvertently punched Shawn Michaels' wife Rebecca in the face. They had a quick clip of it while they covered the feud, but I thought they would actually show it, or they would talk more about that, because that was a great angle, and they didn't really focus on that at all. So that was a little bit disappointing. But they do cover that. Going back a little bit, they cover Jericho, his match with Cena at SummerSlam back in 05, and the next night when he got fired, and then he took 2 years off. They cover him touring with his band Fozzy during that period. They actually dedicate a lot of time to him and Fozzy, so for those of you who are not interested in that, you might have to fast forward through that. The match that got Jericho to come back in 07, the matches that Shawn Michaels and Cena had earlier that year, that's what kind of reignited Jericho's passion in the wrestling business. He came back later that year, the whole Save Us Y2J campaign, and they didn't talk about his feud with JBL at all. They kind of glossed over that. They talked about him going heel, the Shawn Michaels feud, Jericho later on, his great tag team with the Big Show, and they didn't talk at all about any of the legend stuff from WrestleMania last year. They show a very quick clip at some point of Mickey Rourke punching him out, but they didn't talk about that at all, or the matches that he had with Ricky Steamboat, who was his all-time idol. I was a little surprised about that. But other than that, they cover everything you could possibly want them to cover. It's very extensive. Like I said, the documentary is just under 2 hours, and it's well worth the price of the DVD alone. And I haven't even gotten to all the matches on the second and third discs. I think they have about 19 matches, and I've gotten to none of them yet. And they've got a lot of good stuff. I mean, they've got an ECW match with him and Cactus Jack. Apparently Cactus Jack was instrumental in getting him into ECW. And they've got a match with him and Ultimo Dragon, I think, him and Dean Malenko, him and Eddie Guerrero from WCW, him and Rey Mysterio, a couple of matches with Shawn Michaels, a match with Hollywood Hogan from SmackDown in 2002, his WrestleMania match with Michaels, his WrestleMania 26 match with Edge from this year, and just a lot of other really good stuff, including his debut match, which was also Lance Storm's debut match. Jericho and Storm fought one another. This was in Canada back in 1990. They actually got footage of the match, and they have it on the DVD. I have not watched it yet, but that's pretty cool. That's a rare gem right there. And lastly, the extras that I watched from Disc 1 are great. There's a couple of great stories that Jericho tells. Joey Styles has a great story that he tells as well. But they have the two Thrill Seeker vignettes from Smoky Mountain, which are just phenomenal stuff. There's two post-show segments from his WWE days. So they have a post-Raw segment from 2003. That was back, you know, back 5, 6, 7 years ago when Raw would go off the air. I think every single week they would have some sort of interaction, some sort of funny back-and-forth promo or dark match between the wrestlers. They still have dark matches now, but they don't really do too much, I think, when the show goes off the air as much as they used to. In this particular segment, it was a back-and-forth promo from 03 after the cameras went off the air between Jericho and Stone Cold Steve Austin, who was the co-GM at the time. And if you are not a fan of the What chant, which I am not, this segment will drive you nuts. But if you can put that aside, it's still a hell of a segment. It's just a lot of fun to watch. And it went on for, God, 10 or 12 minutes. There's another great segment from last year from SmackDown after the show went off the air. Where Jericho, they're in Philadelphia, the fans are leaving, Jericho asks for the mic, he's just ragging on the crowd and telling them, you know, I haven't given you permission to leave yet, how dare you? And there's an old man in the front row, and as best as I can tell, he's not a plant. Again, the show is already off the air. This is just an old man who is getting very riled up by Jericho, and Jericho goes outside, and it degenerates into a back and forth between Jericho and this old man, who is clearly cursing him out. Flip, you know, he's giving him the F-bombs. Jericho's like, are you using profanity with me? He asks security to come over and remove the guy. It's just really, really funny stuff. So I have not gotten to the matches, but without even doing so, I give a hearty thumbs up to the Chris Jericho Breaking the Code DVD. If you have not picked up your copy yet, it is well worth the price tag. You can probably get it in certain places, Best Buy and whatever, for under $20 even. You don't have to pay, you know, $35 for the Jericho DVD. So definitely pick that up. And I have not gotten to Legendary yet. I still have yet to watch John Cena's fantastic movie. At this rate, I'm probably going to see Big Show's movie Knucklehead before I see Legendary, just because I've always wanted to see Big Show do a WWE comedy. Some of the humor is the type of toilet humor you would expect out of WWE writers, but I still am dying to see Big Show in a comedy, so I will probably see Knucklehead when it comes out. Thing is, they're only releasing it in theaters for 2 days. I mean, it's literally going to be in theaters next Saturday and next Sunday, and that's it. And then I think 2 weeks later it comes out on DVD, and I really don't want to buy the DVD, so I'm going to try to check it out in theaters if it's playing here in New York, and if it isn't, I will try to find other means to see Knucklehead. So I may have a Knucklehead review before I have a Legendary review. Anyway, with that said, let's get to some quick feedback here. I can't cover it all. We're running a little over time. Let's see some of your questions. By the way, SE Scoops mailbag every single week. I work on that as well. So you can send me questions to thesolemonster at gmail.com for this podcast. But if you have questions that you'd like me to potentially post on the website when I do the SE Scoops mailbag each week, which is usually sometime between Wednesday and Friday, send those questions into the main address at sescoops at gmail.com. Just wanted to get that out of the way. I asked you guys last week to email me with your scariest wrestling moments. Here in the spirit of Halloween, it could be a scary character, it could be a scary bump that somebody took. I'll just get to a few quick ones here. This one comes in from Tyler. Here, Solomonster, the scariest moment I can remember was November 1st, 2003, at Ring of Honor's Main Event Spectacles, when Teddy Hart kept on doing moonsaults off the top of the cage, beating up the wrestlers outside the ring, then working himself up enough where he threw in the ring. I'm not sure what that means. And throughout this whole incident, none of the other wrestlers knew that he was going to do any of his crazy maneuvers. That was the scariest moment I remember, because I just could not believe why in the world he would do this and potentially injure other wrestlers who were unprepared for his moves. If I remember correctly, I remember one of those big moonsaults off the top of the cage, and I remember that being it for Teddy Hart in Ring of Honor. That was the last straw. Basically, he went into business for himself to make himself look good. That's why Teddy Hart's not in WWE. Teddy Hart is his own worst enemy. You know, he's working down in Mexico. He probably will never, ever get a shot in the big leagues, and it's his own fault. But I remember him doing that in Ring of Honor. And Gabe Sapolsky and the folks at ROH said that you would never again see Teddy Hart in Ring of Honor. And I don't think he ever was. If he was, maybe he was once, but I don't remember him ever being invited back. And that would be why. Greg has his own scary moment. Dear Solomonster, I was racking my brain, I should say, to find a scary moment over the last 15 years I've been watching wrestling. One that sticks out would be the Four Corners match at the WCW Sin pay-per-view, January of 2001. In the match, Sid Vicious jumped from the second turnbuckle to deliver a flying big boot to Scott Steiner, and when he landed, he broke his leg in two places. It's the first time I can remember seeing a bone break during a bad bump. Not that it hasn't happened before, I just may not have seen it. That is one of the sickest moments, I agree, that I've ever seen in a wrestling match. You can find the video on YouTube, but do so at your own peril if you have a weak stomach. Sid, as he tells the story, was hesitant about doing this move off the second turnbuckle, but he was told that he had to do it. And at one point in the match, he climbs up to the second rope on the inside and comes off with, I don't remember if he was doing a double axe handle or if Scott Steiner was going to give him a big boot to the face, but when he came down, I think it was his left leg, his left ankle, you could see the bone break. You can see, I mean, it is sickening to even think of. When he falls to the ground, he's laying there, his boot is hanging off. And he
clutches his leg. He knew right away, obviously, that something happened. What makes that moment scary, though, to me, even more so than the break, what makes that moment scary is the fact that nobody else knew what was going on. I mean, I think at that moment, Rick Steiner or somebody was doing a run-in. The crowd, if you look out in the audience during the clip, it doesn't look like anybody in the audience knew what happened. I don't think Scott Steiner knew. I don't think the referee knew right away. I mean, I think he figured it out pretty quickly, but at first, nobody knew. And that's what made it even more scary to me. And thankfully, nobody, you know, touched the leg or made it any worse. Kind of amazing that Sid has, you know, he hasn't been given a shot yet in the big leagues to come back, but the fact that Sid was able to come back at all. And again, at that point, he was already an older guy. And the fact that he trained and rehabbed and was able to come back and start wrestling again on the independents is a pretty good testament to his determination. I'll give him a lot of credit for that because I didn't think there was any coming back from that injury. It's a little bit different if you have a guy that's in his 20s coming back from an injury like that. And even then, it would be questionable. But to think that 40-something-year-old Sid was able to come back from that, it's not an easy thing to do. Bill Mitchell writes into the podcast, Solemn Monster, I have two scary moments in pro wrestling, although I didn't see it in person. The first one, and I think the scariest bump I've ever seen, was the one of New Jack tossing Vic Grimes off the scaffold years ago. I believe that was in ECW. When I saw this footage, I actually thought that New Jack killed Vic. Watching Vic bounce the way he did was just scary. In fact, the scariest thing I've ever seen. I've seen this video, and to me, it's scary, but it's also one of the stupidest things I've ever seen in my life. And it is amazing that Vic Grimes did not die. I mean, he is tossed off the top of a scaffold, and in the ring, I think they had three or four tables stacked up as high as the eye can see. And the goal was that, if I remember correctly, he was trying to throw Vic through the tables, and Vic, I mean, he took a flip bump off the scaffold and fell and hit the ropes, and his body kind of bounced off the ropes in a very weird way. It looked like he got tangled up in the mass of tables, if I'm remembering this correctly. That was the scariest and also one of the stupidest things I think I've ever seen. Anyway, Bill's second moment here. The scariest thing I saw in person had to be the Magnum TA versus Tully Blanchard I Quit Cage match for the television title at Starrcade 85 when Magnum took the makeshift spike and just drilled Tully with it, forcing him to utter those famous words, yes, yes, I quit, I quit. And wow, so that was a hell of a show for Bill to be at. That match has actually been on a couple of WWE DVDs that they've produced, at least one of them. I think maybe even more than one. So I remember that scene of Magnum with the spike just about ready to jab it right in Tully's eye, and Tully is holding the spike, just holding it away from his eyeball, and then he finally quits. That was good stuff, so I could see where, looks like Bill says he was 8 years old when that match happened. I could see an 8-year-old being potentially scarred for life by something like that. Jonathan writes in, Dear Solemn Monster, I was watching a Triple H Randy Orton stretcher match the other day. The thought of a stretcher match just seems so daft. What match stipulations do you not like, and why? The one that comes to mind, the one that I just really don't care for much, are strap matches. And maybe it's just the way they do them now. Just the idea that, you know, you've got these two guys bound by this leather strap, and you've got to touch each turnbuckle, and if the guy interrupts, you have to start all over again. To me, it's just fucking stupid. That's just stupid. If you're going to have a strap match where the strap is legally used as a weapon to whip the other opponent, but you still have to win by pinfall or submission, to me, that would make more sense. But the whole thing about, you know, dragging the guy from corner to corner, to me, it's stupid. And WWE stretcher matches are even more stupid. You know, having to roll somebody over a yellow line. I mean, the only stretcher match I ever saw in WWE that I really liked, that I thought was really, really good, that they made work, was, I believe, Judgment Day in 2003, which would have been Brock Lesnar and The Big Show. I just remember, of all the stretcher matches I've seen, theirs is the one that I was impressed by the most. But, I mean, you're right. In general, based on WWE rules, stretcher matches are just as stupid as their strap matches. I got a letter from Luke, who was talking about pillar boxing on the Chris Jericho DVD that he noticed. If you watch it on an HDTV or on your computer, you might notice this pillar boxing that I guess, according to Luke, has been a pattern recently with WWE DVDs, where you'll have the presentation kind of centered, and off to the left and the right, you have this background, which is kind of annoying.
I watched the Jericho DVD on a non-HD TV and did not notice any pillar boxing at all. So what I'll do when this podcast is over, I may just pop in that first disc into my laptop and see if I notice it on there. Because I watched it on a standard definition, old, you know, 25-inch TV, and noticed no such pillar boxing. So it may be an HD thing, it may be a computer thing. I'll pop it into my laptop later and check it out and let you know what the outcome of that is. But if anybody else has noticed this, let me know if this is a pattern, and if so, what you think about it. I got a letter from Andrew here. Great stuff, Solomonster. Funny with the zombie interview, and funny that he should mention the zombie survival guide. It was written by Max Brooks, and he comes to colleges and speaks to people about how to survive a zombie attack. He's really good. I have not checked out the zombie survival guide, but after my my interview last week with the zombie himself, I have to say I am kind of interested to check that out. Thanks for the kind words on that. Marcus writes into the Sound Off. Been listening since episode 82. Just want to thank you for all the hard work you put in. You are my weekly entertainment, so I thank you for that. Anyway, in 2002, when Stone Cold was having problems with WWE and walked out, would you happen to know what was behind that happening? I actually answered this question as part of one of the SE Scoops mailbags a couple of weeks ago, but the short version is that Austin was not very happy at the time for a variety of reasons. He was not thrilled with ideas that were being pitched to him by WWE Creative. He was very beat up, even though he wasn't telling people he was as beat up as he was. His neck was bothering him. And the straw that broke the camel's back was in June of 02 on an episode of Raw, Vince McMahon told Austin that he was being booked in a match with Brock Lesnar, who at the time was only first really being given the big push. He was being billed as the next big thing, and they had big plans for him. And he was getting the mega push as the young guy at the time, and they wanted to actually put Lesnar over Austin in a free match with no build on Raw as a King of the Ring tournament qualifier. And as Austin tells the story, it wasn't that he had a problem putting over Brock Lesnar. What he had a problem with was giving that match away for free on television with no build-up whatsoever, which is what TNA does all the time. But Austin didn't think that was good for business, and Vince McMahon would not waver. He was booked to lose to Lesnar, and instead Austin opted to pack his bags and go home. And that was when they had The Rock, who was supposed to be coming back to TV the next month, but they rushed him back early because they needed somebody to take Austin's place. Not that he was going to wrestle in Austin's place, but just they needed a big baby face that they were now lacking. And Austin didn't come back until February of 03. He was gone from the company for a good 7 or 8 months, and that was pretty much the story behind it. Lawrence from New Jersey writes in with an interesting idea for bragging rights. First, he says, "Hey, Solomonster, I've been a fan since Sound Off 50-something. I love your work. It gets better with every podcast. Quick thought regarding bragging rights I wanted to get your opinion on. I think the concept is completely boring because nothing of value is on the line. What if that brand that won the match would have their brand's match as the final match at WrestleMania? I think this would serve two purposes. First, it adds something of value to the event. You could think of it as analogous to home field advantage in the World Series for the league that wins the All-Star game. Secondly, it would force the writing staff to have the WrestleMania main events mapped out and planned to an extent by bragging rights, since they obviously would not want to have the wrong match highlighting that show. What are your thoughts?" I think that's a great idea. But again, you're expecting that WWE knows today what their WrestleMania main events are going to be. Now, in fairness to them, they, last year, had a pretty good sense by November, December, of what their WrestleMania main events were going to be. They're already giving thought to what they want their WrestleMania matches to be, but they don't know yet. But the idea that, in a way, home field advantage for the winning brand would be on the line, I'm not sure that alone is enough to really draw interest in the pay-per-view. In fact, I'm almost positive it really wouldn't make a huge difference. But at least, you're right, at least it would give something of value on the line in that match. I think that's a fine idea. I think anything of any sort of value than a fucking trophy that nobody cares about would help the bragging rights match mean more. Got an email from Eco, just call him Eco since he doesn't have a name listed here, that he sent after Impact, very angry with Impact from Thursday night. "Solomonster, I found myself surprised, appalled, and straight out disappointed with tonight's Impact, and it isn't even over yet. It took them an hour and 15 minutes before they had a match. That is bullshit. The only reason I'm still watching is because this is like looking at a very bad car wreck that you can't take your eyes off of. They say 2012, there will be a series of events that will cause the end of the world. I don't know if that's true or not, but this right now is TNA's 2012, because I can't see this company being on the air for much longer, let alone staying in business. TNA's end is approaching, and the funny thing is, I doubt anyone gives a flying fuck about it. Obviously, he was not very happy with Impact from Thursday. I actually did not get a single email from somebody who liked Impact. I'm not saying that there aren't people listening to this podcast that didn't like Impact or who have a different opinion from mine. That's fine. I'm just saying I didn't get a single email from one person, or else I would read it right now. I don't really have anything to counter Eco's email with, so there you go. And last but not least here, we have an email from our good buddy Ed. Been a loyal listener since 100 episodes ago. In the last week, WWE has stopped using entrance videos for superstars and in their place have been using generic animations. For example, Undertaker came out on SmackDown and his video was replaced by his cross symbol. My question is, do you know if they are just doing that for TV and if you had any insight on why they started doing that all of a sudden? As I said to Ed, I hadn't even noticed this until he brought it up. And what it reminds me of is what they used to do back around 1992-93, when the wrestler Trons, I guess you would say, were essentially just their logos. You may remember back then Shawn Michaels had his little broken heart logo with the blood leaking out, and you know, Doink the Clown had his logo, and Mr. Perfect had his logo with the royal columns. And all the videos were back then on the tinier little Titantrons were you'd have some sort of... it's these very basic kind of graphic animation effects that would then reveal the logo. And that really was all it was. There was no video of the wrestler wrestling or anything. That's kind of what this reminds me of. I don't know of any specific reason they started doing it. I guess maybe they're just trying something different. But in all honesty, before you mentioned it, I didn't even notice. So there you go. And that's going to do it for the mailbag this week. Going to have to wrap this bad boy up and get to the rest of your questions next week. In the meantime, send me in some new questions, Solomonster, the Solomonster, I should say, at gmail.com, as always. And like I said earlier, if you have questions for the SE Scoops mailbag that I post on the site once a week, those questions should go directly to sescoops@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Solomonster, and friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/TheSolomonster. We might be doing another Twitter or Facebook-only mailbag soon. So if you want to get in on that, you got to friend me on there. And once my status goes up, you can post questions, and I'll do them on the podcast. I'm not doing it yet, but I may be doing another one in the future. So get on Facebook if you are not already on there. So that's going to do it. Episode 130 in the books. Thank you, everybody, for listening to the show, as always. The numbers are up, people like what they're hearing, and that's really all that matters. I'm happy that you guys are enjoying the show each and every week, and certainly hope that you enjoyed it more than Impact this week. I mean, my God, what a show that Impact was. Be well, stay safe, we'll see you back here next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster sounds off on SEScoops.com.